Hello, you're listening to the Gambling Files podcast, the podcast that doesn't have any files but is about gambling, so we're at least two-thirds correct. My name's John Bruford. I'm your co-host. My co-host is the ever-hirsute Fintan Costello. Fintan, welcome.
That's a word I've never heard pronounced. I've only ever seen written down. Could you say it again, please, just so I get the pronunciation right?
Fintan.
You know what I meant.
Most people say hirsute because, you know, they want to sound erudite, but I say hirsute. Hirsute.
Nice. Okay. I see.
You can't. How would you say it?
Hirsute. I have no idea. Oh, mate, you don't want to know.
Hirsute.
My wife catches these things in the moment of like, Fintan, that's not how you pronounce that word. And usually it's just stuff I've seen written. I've never actually heard or used in a normal conversation. So thank you for educating me yet again, John. Appreciate it.
Do you know what? You're here to ask the smart questions of people. So I just feel good that I've contributed something somewhere today. You know, because it's been a tough day. Do you know what? I woke up this morning to the sound of torrential rain and then realized that the torrential rain sound was in my bedroom. So I spent the morning moving furniture from my bedroom away from the rain that was coming through the ceiling.
Because I was going to say, if you're waking up in Wales to the sound of torrential rain and you're upset, you're in the wrong country. But okay, it's coming through the ceiling.
It's a very, very good point. But no, it was not good. And so I phoned the agent that handles the rental, and they said, we'll try and get somebody out this week. Like,
oh, no rush.
Fuck off. I said to him, if this was your house, would this week be okay with you? Because I think it's a bit more urgent, and I think my landlord is going to think it's a bit more urgent as well. They're like, well, I do see what you mean. Great. Haven't heard a peep from them since. Twat.
You're now living in the swimming pool. Is that what's...
I just took all of my finest kitchen implements, saucepans, baking trays, that kind of thing, and just stuck them on the floor.
I thought you were going to say you took them out of the bedroom. I'm like, what do you do with all that in your bedroom?
Mattress is on the floor in my boy's room. My wardrobe's in my daughter's room. And hopefully this will be sorted before they
come. Is it a two-story house? Because it could like destroy the floor, the upstairs floors, or is it a bungalow?
It's a two-story house. But I'm feeling confident that I've got most of the drips. Also, the rain's eased off quite a lot, but the forecast for the next few days, well, let's just say I could be homeless this time next week.
That's February in Wales, right? That's...
If only I knew somebody that had an insane amount of money that could buy me a house.
Get in the fucking queue, mate. Get in the queue.
Jesus.
Oh, Fintan. Can we also talk about truffles? There was a lot of truffle talk last week.
Well, Fintan, you should be on here as a guest talking about truffles because you are the man.
I was listening to the show on my run last week for the segments I didn't show up for, and there was a lot of truffle pig discussions as well. And I'd like to just inform
everybody. It's an investment
everybody.
For you.
No. You don't want the truffle pig. You want the truffle dog, right? Because the pigs, it's very hard to stop the pigs from eating the truffles.
Oh.
Right, the dogs are way better behaved, and the dogs will just kind of like, it's like, you know, that's why the dogs aren't snorting cocaine in the airports, and the dogs will find it and then just like tell you for a tennis ball and a biscuit. So it's all about the truffle dogs, not the truffle pigs. People, don't listen to Big Truffle. They're out to get you.
I can't believe you've researched this.
It's just something I already knew. Because
you aspired to have one.
I watch a lot of Discovery Channel.
Okay. So tell me about your truffle adventures.
That was it. That's all I had. That was my truffle
fact. Are you telling me that you haven't been eating truffles this week?
Oh, I did. I had I did. You set me up there. Nice. There's I tried, because I was laughing when you were talking about truffles. There's this new cafe. My son does this class, like a acrobatics thing. And I call it clown school, but he hates that. And there's a new cafe nearby, and their whole theme is truffle. And so I went, and I had a bit of time to kill, so I had like a salmon sandwich and had this like really nice truffle mayonnaise. And I was saying to the waiter, oh my God, this truffle mayonnaise is amazing. It's like, it should be illegal. And it was actually the owner. And he's like, oh, I made it myself. And he's talking about recipes and stuff. And then he's like, but if you really want to try truffle crack, I've got something for you. So he shows up with a little dish of honey and some sliced cheese. And so what he's done is he's blended some truffle oil into the honey. And then obviously you have it with the cheese. And I like honey. It's my secret little guilty pleasure. But he's ruined honey for me now, because if it doesn't have truffle honey, it's just not honey for me anymore. It was amazing. So I'd highly recommend truffle honey.
So I think it's fair to say that you're going to spunk your bonus find a fortune on truffle crack. Found in an alley in a couple of years, just with honey smeared around your mouth.
My wife is far too smart for that. I'm not going to get. I'll get my allowance, and that'll be it. She's going to, you know, it's fine. It's never going to happen.
It's very generous of her. Something I've been thinking about quite a bit to keep it topical. I think we should have a halftime show on the podcast.
Like I'll get my nipples out kind of halftime show, or like what are we talking about?
Well, we could switch to video and we could totally do that. But I'm not really sure. I don't know if we could get Dr. Dre, but we could probably get Dr. Jones from my local GP.
Well, Snoop will show up for anything. Like Snoop's like the presenter of choice in America now. So we could probably get Snoop in.
Hmm.
Put in some calls.
Well, you probably could. You just lure him with some of that truffle ganja.
I'm not even in the Snoop territory. That could work. That could be a thing.
What, truffle ganja?
Yeah, our own little dispensary in America. That could be cool.
You'd want your truffle ganja dispensary to be in Beverly Hills, I think.
I don't think it matters. It's tasty. I don't know. I'm not an expert in these things.
But, you know, the Super Bowl happened just recently, tighter game than many people predicted, for those that understand American football. Maybe we could call it rugby soccer. Maybe that would be a better way to describe it. The numbers that have been bandied about for the actual amount of bets that have been wagered is quite big, but it will be really interesting to see all the numbers that are coming out gradually from the different regions that have recently allowed sports betting, how disproportionately it skews them over the year as well.
Yeah, there was something today out of New York, right? So I think New York's done more tax this month than New Jersey did all year or something crazy. Like there's some just ridiculous numbers coming out of some of the states. And it'll only get bigger as more and more states legalize as well. So this is just the foothill of the Everest that is US sports betting.
Yeah, probably is. But let's hope that... Well, you know, everybody bets responsibly. But that does bring me neatly into our second guest today, Dr. Michael Auer, because he
solves the problem of... You didn't talk about our first guy.
We're coming back to that.
I'm jumping forward.
It's a non-linear path. Think of it as the intro version of Pulp Fiction.
Got it.
Dr. Michael Auer of Necton fame solves problem gambling.
He is
good. Preceded by our first guest, Mr. Charles Cohen. And Charles solves the problem of affordability checks. I mean, it's a big problem-solving show today.
And not only did he solve affordability, he also solved single customer view in a very elegant way.
And how to begin and end a speech.
Yes, indeed.
It's just solid gold.
It's just surrounding ourselves with genius. That's what we do.
We're like, and this might not make any sense to any non-UK people, but we're like the hits compilations of years gone by. We are the now that's what I call music compilations of the gambling podcast world.
That's what we should have gone for.
That's what I call gambling.
Dude, and we'd have like the numbers 57.
Oh, shit on us.
We're going to have to rebrand. We've totally, totally messed this one up.
Oh, we've spunk that, haven't we? Jeez.
Oh, it's just the ads just write them. Oh, no. Oh,
Fenton, can you get on? Can you get on whois.com and check the domain?
We've ruined it.
Well, now we can get this up and running by next week.
Yeah, if we buy the domain before the podcast goes out.
Oh yeah, that's a good call. Because otherwise, somebody will cyber squat.
I'm on it.
But it's also just before we sign off. It's very interesting still what's going on with ICE, because the organizers still being very bullish, and a release came out about Cami, hugely respected roulette wheel manufacturer, and they do loads of other stuff now as well, do some really interesting stuff, Cami. But Cami have come out and said, yeah, we're going.
That's good.
But, I mean, it's brilliant. I mean, those guys are, and that kind of product are, you know, among the staples of this kind of event. But also I've heard of three companies that are not Cami who, and I can't even say their names because I'm not allowed, they won't let me. I've heard from three companies today who are not exhibiting. And you know, that's just the ones that have contacted me. So I still think that the status of ICE is up in the air, and that might not be the popular view, but I think this one still has some distance to run, and it may end up being a very, very heavily iGaming event.
I'm going to call the opposite, and I think it will absolutely go ahead.
Based on what?
Because I'm going is the short answer.
I want it to go ahead because, I mean, we've got the casino awards on the opening night.
I think it's good. Oh, so go on.
Organized by myself and Casino International Publishers Data Team Business Media Limited, and supported by the European Casino Association and everybody else that has good taste in things to do in an evening at ICE. totally scripted. Totally scripted.
My God, it just rolled off the tongue. But no, I think it's going to go ahead. I think it'll be different. But I think it's one of those, you know, things evolve, things change. And I think a load of people are going to show up.
Do you know, I hope you're right, because the land-based side of the industry needs an event. We need something to congregate around.
Oh, look, don't get me wrong. There's definitely going to be, like, I think there'll be a European event or something else as well. Because, you know, if a lot of these big brands have pulled out, there's marketing managers sitting on a lot of marketing budget that they're desperate to spend. So a bit like water, it'll find its way.
Well, you say that they're desperate to spend marketing budget, Fenton. Don't forget that our podcast is very much available for sponsorship opportunities. A theme that just keeps recurring in conversation.
This is a very, very good point. You know, if they took like a 1% of what they would have spent just on the drinks,
we'd both be happy.
We'd be set for the year. That'd be great.
It would certainly pay all of our hosting costs.
It would definitely cover the truffle honey as well.
Well, yeah, for you. I mean, I don't have such extravagant tastes.
Yes, you know, do,
me and
yeah.
Me and sugar, we don't.
Of course, because you're a carnivore, right? You did the whole.
Yeah, we don't mix very well.
But then you're skinny. See, it worked. It worked. You got skinny, though.
So, well, skinny, it's all relative, though, isn't it?
So the typing of me buying that domain name, by the way. Oh, shit.
No, that's fine. You're not, though. You're looking at mermaid porn, aren't you?
I'm buying one. No, I'm literally buying the domain name.
Anybody that listens to the whole episode, the mermaid porn reference will become clear later, and it will be me looking at the mermaid porn, not Fenton. But for clarity, I don't really watch mermaid porn, and I certainly don't look at it while I'm doing the podcast. I mean, if I did look at it, I wouldn't do it then. But I don't look at it, So I'm just glad we took the time to clear that up.
Yeah, pervert.
Rescue that. That could have gone badly wrong. Enjoy the episode. We have Charles Cohen first, followed by Dr. Michael Auer. Charles, as we said, is talking about solving the problem of affordability checks. And it really is interesting, and he's got a tremendous solution. And Dr. Auer is talking about his approach, the role of AI in problem gambling, and what he's done about it fundamentally. So give him a listen, because, you know, that's what you're here for if you heard that.
Yeah, they're really good guys. Give them a listen. And if you don't have their solutions in place, definitely give them a call.
And we won't charge them for plugging them.
No, they're definitely not paying us.
They're really not.
They're paying us not to talk about them.
Oh, man. That's what
that could
do.
Be it. That could be it. We do like the anti-ads and it's like the...
charging for protection, couldn't it?
Yeah. We won't do an ad.
Yeah.
Because we had a great idea during the week, but it got shut down for a lot of legal reasons. Thanks, Mel. It was perfect.
Really was very good.
They weren't brave enough. You got to be brave.
You do have to be brave. If there are any terribly, terribly brave companies out there, give us a shout. Enjoy the episode. We move neatly sideways to our first guest of the day, Mr. Charles Cohen, founder of, Charles, if I get this wrong, do you know what? I'm happy to own my mistakes. If I get this wrong, I got it wrong. Founder of Department of Trust.
That's right.
Is that right? Yes, get in.
Bravo.
Thank you.
We're off to a flying start there.
Many, many people in the industry will know your name from your time at IGT. And so hang on. If I remember, you had a company that was bought by IGT, right?
That's right. I started Probability, which was one of the early pioneers in the mobile gaming space. So we used to go along with about Million to One, you know, Chris Sheffield and the guys at MFuse, and we'd turn up at conferences and be in the mobile gaming room, and we'd be the only three people there because no one thought that anyone would ever gamble on a mobile phone. And here we are now.
Yeah, how times change. But you left IGT a year or so ago. I'm not like stalking you.
No, that's not right. I was in the US and I got caught, I mean, literally, quite literally caught in London at the beginning of the first lockdown. And, you know, it was just a complete disaster. Trump canceled all the visas and eventually I just couldn't go back. And so I had to give it up really because I couldn't really run a US sports betting business from central London. It was a real shame. I really, really loved my time at IGT. It was a fantastic place to work. But, you know, one door closes, another opens.
Do you know Phil?
Which Phil? There are many.
Works at IGT.
Phil O'Shaughnessy, you mean?
Yes, I do. That is a phenomenal guess.
Yeah, he's a great guy. He's a lovely man. Yeah.
He's a total legend.
Yeah. There's a bunch of really great people working there, actually. It gets a bad rap, you know, because it's considered to be the establishment, you know, big, slow company. But actually, there's a lot of really fantastic, creative, talented people there, good people.
I'll tell you something quite interesting, and this genuinely, I think it's interesting. Anybody can stop me if I'm wrong. Often the perception of a company from outside is that the bigger the company, the greater brand protection that they try and employ, etc. And, you know, I used to edit a magazine for consumer DVDs, basically. And so dealing with like Warner Brothers, anything with Lucasfilm, fucking nightmare. And really doom. Anything to do with the Harry Potter license, Star Wars license, complete pain in the ass. Absolutely make you jump through hoops, and for what ultimately, really. So you think that that's the way things are. But actually, what IGT do, and I believe they do this with most of the people in B2B publishing in the casino industry, is they let you get on with your job, and they're not overly cautious. They, you know, they'll get you somebody to interview, say, do you want some time with this person? You say, yes, please. They don't need to see it before it's published or anything. You know, they don't ask that horrible question, can we see this before publication? They let you get on with it. Even me, which, you know.
Even you.
It's a gamble.
Massive risk.
Yeah, massive risk. Well, they've obviously got good lawyers and fabulous insurance.
But John's got no money, so there's nothing. Like, it's just whistling. It's just like...
Seriously, you can't threaten somebody that literally has nothing.
He's got nothing to... Yeah. It's like one of those movies where he's got nothing to lose.
Everything.
Yeah, I will find you and I will kill you. The thing with IGT is that it's culturally, it's very, very aware that the world doesn't owe it a living. And all of the people in there, certainly in the time that I was there and the things that I was doing in mobile and then sports betting, everybody understood that, we might be the leader, but that in a sense brings its own challenges and it makes you a target. It's because you're the one that everyone's trying to beat, even actually if that's not really appropriate. And, you know, they don't take it for granted. You actually should interview Enrico Drago, who was my boss, is the head of the Play Digital section. I think he's probably better to talk about the company than me. But and he had Walter on as well last week. He's also left. So, yeah, great people, really, really interesting culture.
Yeah, no, I'm a big fan, and I've dealt with them so much over I've been at Editing Casino International for 15, 16 years, and it's been almost universally a good experience with IGT. And I would like to say it's been a good experience with everybody across the board.
but it hasn't.
It hasn't, no. But you're here today, Charles, not to suck up to your IGT former buddies, including Phil O'Shaughnessy, total legend. I should also probably mention Michelle Schenck as well. Big fan.
Total legend. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yes. Absolute superstar. They're both just lovely, lovely people. But anyway, no.
You do realize that people listening to this will have no idea who we're talking about, right?
It's possible. But, you know, if you're curious, look them up. You know, they're probably on LinkedIn. Yeah. You drop them a line and say, hey, you're very nice. That's how you should start your pitch. When you send your connection mail, just be, I hear you're very nice. Please connect with me on LinkedIn.
Or say you're a friend of John's and then they'll block you.
Don't forewarn them. but no, you, what we were talking about is, or what we are here to talk about is, you, Charles, have recognized an opportunity within the gaming space. And Fintan and I both think you're very much onto something here. What are you doing now with Department of Trust?
I mean, it's interesting seeing it as an opportunity. It's almost embarrassing to say. When I left IGT and I was thinking about what that I want to do next, and I'd done product, I'd done platforms, done betting, and done games and operations. The thing that I kept coming back to over and over again was a problem that I had first encountered in probability. So, you know, you're talking like 15 years ago, which was the times when we were dealing with customers who we were concerned about whether or not they could afford their gambling. And, you know, you got to remember back then, there wasn't even regulation requiring you to ID verify somebody. So it was entirely down to your own kind of ethical position, whether or not you felt you had a duty of care to your customers, because the regulators just weren't interested. And this is, you know, even before the Gambling Act in the UK. But we took it very seriously because, you know, frankly, none of us wanted to get up and go to work in the morning with the intent of you know, damaging people, harming them. We wanted to run an entertainment business. And some of the interactions that you had with customers who were having difficulties were really quite distressing. And, you know, after selling the company and moving into IGT, I didn't really get another chance to look at it. But when I left and I started asking people, you know, what's going on? What's interesting? What are the problems? And I was expecting, you know, it would be about payments or ID or, you know, using AI to improve conversion, all of that kind of stuff, right, which people are doing. The thing that kept coming over and over again was affordability, which has become a kind of catch-all for everything under the responsible gambling banner. And I looked, the more I looked into it, the more I realized that nobody from within the industry had ever really taken a systematic product and customer-oriented approach to solving this, even understanding this problem, let alone solving it. And I decided that's what I was going to have a go at. And 14 months later, here we are with a business that's just about to go live.
Ooh. It's pretty exciting. So have you fixed it?
If there was a silver bullet that you could fire to solve this problem, it would have been found a long time ago. So I don't think I can claim that we've fixed it, but I think we know where the solution is. And that is in the finding a way for players to easily and confidently share information about themselves through their, effectively through their bank statements, their bank data, which is the absolute gold standard of any sort of affordability check. And to make the information available to gambling operators in a way that protects people's privacy and is done in a non-intrusive way.
Because that's the key problem, right? That you get an email from your bookmaker or your casino saying, hey, we need a copy of your passport. We need two utility bills. And we need a wage slip and how do you earn your living and, show us your bank statement. Like it's a very intrusive process.
It's extraordinary. And of course, the people who receive those requests are your best customers because most operators work on a tripwire system, which is you're allowed in, we'll do a check to see whether you've got any county court judgments or bankruptcies outstanding, which are pretty meaningless in this context anyway. We will let you play and then we'll set a soft limit of, you know, whatever it is, £250, say. And as soon as you reach that level, in other words, as soon as you become potentially a profitable customer to us and a loyal customer to us, instead of investing in the relationship, we're going to phone you up and ask to see your bank statement, which is just unbelievable. I mean, you can imagine if that happened in any other walk of life, other than setting up a mortgage.
You go to a car dealership, you want to buy a really expensive car, and it's like, let's sit you down there for a minute. Let's have a look at your bank statement. And, you know, it does. I can see why affordability checks happen. I do agree with them. But there's from the human perspective, handing, you know, particularly if it's the first time you've ever been asked, it's such a shock. Because like you said, it is like, okay, for a mortgage application, maybe, or actually, yes. But it's such a shock. Yeah, because you know.
You expect it for a mortgage application. You don't expect it because you want to put some money on the 330 at Lingfield.
And you're more likely to go, screw this, I'm just going to go open up an account at a different bookies and just churn. Like,
so I'm guessing a lot of people. I mean, obviously, if you speak to an operator, they will tell you that on a good day, they'll have, for every 10 people they'll ask, three of them will agree to send the data and two of them will actually do it. you know. And in the meantime, whilst they're waiting for the bank statements, of course, they have to either limit the account or, in some cases, suspend it altogether. And of course, the customer, because the customer's not expecting it or used to it, the customer thinks they've somehow done something wrong. Which, of course, they haven't. All they've done is played with this operator. And so the whole thing gets off on the wrong foot. And you're absolutely right. That's what happens, is that these people then simply go, they shut the account, they take their money, and they go somewhere else. And they go what I call limit shopping, which is that they'll go to another operator. They'll wager up to whatever that operator's limit is for an affordability check, and then as soon as they get the phone call, they're off somewhere else. You know, and it's just shocking. And and what amazes me about it is how so many operators have just internalized this as a cost of doing business. And it's almost a kind of a defeat, admitting defeat that there's no better way of doing it.
And then I suppose there's the second issue then of, you've then now received a bunch of very sensitive documents. Somebody needs to review them and make a decision, which is one part of it. But then you've got to like store them safely. And
yep.
In a post, I still haven't met anybody who actually understands like GDPR or anything like that. But like that to me just sounds like, as a small business, that just sounds like an absolute nightmare.
Yeah, we actually did some research with YouGov before sort of jumping into this thing, and concern about what happens to the data is the number two concern of people when they refuse to who would refuse to share. You know, and you know, gambling companies are not regulated financial institutions; they're gambling companies, right? So they're not built to process this sort of information. I mean, one of the other problems you've got with this whole thing is that bank data is notoriously difficult to understand. And if you receive it in the form of someone scanning their bank statements, the chances of you misreading it or misunderstanding it or just making an error are very, very high. And it's just, you know, it's just the worst of all possible worlds for everybody.
Yeah. It's look, I deal with a lot of affiliate managers, and the amount of copies of my passport that are probably floating around the internet right now is just gives me chills sometimes.
I could probably buy it for like half a Bitcoin.
Mate, get me a good dig. Get me a hybrid CPA rev share deal, and I'll just email it to you. Don't worry about that. It's even worse on the affiliate side, because it's like you're just emailing an affiliate manager to their inbox, and you know it's not been stored safely.
So, you know, I thought there must be a better way of doing it, right? The inspiration for what we ended up with, where we've ended up, is from personal budgeting apps. So there are lots of apps that you can download now that will tell you how much you spend on groceries and whether or not you can get a cheaper deal on your mobile phone and stuff like that. And they're pretty successful. You know, people have multiple bank accounts. They've got complicated financial lives. And because of open banking, you can now build a system that will collect and process all this data in a very efficient, very convenient way for everybody. And I thought, well, the answer is blindingly obvious. Let's create a personal finance management tool for people who gamble. So it's not about gambling per se. It's about managing your money. And it's very much positioned as a sort of a free money manager rather than a tool for dealing with problem gambling or anything like that. Then the second half of it, the flip side of that, is that a gambling operator who wants, for example, to see what income you get can ask you to share that information through the app, which means that you as the consumer retain all the power and the control, which is I think, probably the key factor here, because you know who's asking for your data, what data they're asking for, and then you know what happens to it. Because you decide what you want to share, and they only see what you want them to see. So, for example, if a company asks to see my income, that is all that they will find out. They won't see anything else that, you know, what my Netflix subscription or my Marks and Spencer habit looks like, because they're not seeing my bank statements. They're only seeing the information that is pertinent to their inquiry.
So if we take a step back, so you've thrown out a big phrase, open banking. I've got a vague understanding of what it is. Can you give us kind of like, what is open banking? Is it living up to the hype? Where is it currently right now in, say, the UK? And just give us a quick overview on that.
Yeah, sure. So open banking is an initiative that has been going for, I think, about 5 years now. And it is a mandate from the UK financial regulator, but actually it's also all over Europe with a thing called PSD2. And it basically requires the banks to make APIs available to approved fintech businesses, so FCA-regulated fintech businesses, who are allowed to, with the consumer's permission, access the data in their bank accounts. And there's another part of it which allows you to facilitate payments, so directly to and from people's bank accounts. And the idea of open banking is that it allows innovative tech companies to come in and offer financial services that normally wouldn't be possible unless they were a bank. And it's now, I mean, pretty much in the UK, I'd say there's probably 90%, if not higher, of all bank accounts are covered by open banking. There are a few banks that are holdouts to it for some reason, like the Co-op. I don't understand why. Maybe they're just not ready for it, but they've all been told they've got to do it. And so it means that you can connect your bank account. And if anyone's listening and wants to know what does it mean in practice, so if you go into your app or you download one of these budgeting tools and it does an analysis that tells you how much you spend in the supermarket each month, that is a classic open banking use case. Because somebody has taken that data, run it through a pretty sophisticated categorization engine, and return the information. And that's what open banking is. I mean, the hype about it, nothing ever lives up to its hype by definition, but the hype around open banking was mostly around payments and account switching and stuff like that. And I think people are beginning to understand that actually it can be very useful, but not for its own sake. And it's beginning to be applied in things like what we're doing, actually, and people are doing something similar to what we're doing in the rental market. So, you know, rather than sending your bank statements to your landlord or a potential landlord, they can get an affordability or sort of a financial stability score through a third-party app like Canopy. And that, again, uses open banking. So I think we're beginning to see the emergence of these businesses who are actually making valuable applications of the technology rather than yet another app to tell you whether you're spending too much on your gas and electricity.
And it makes sense because it gives people control over their financial data, which is fantastic, I think. So when we look at this then from the bookies perspective or the operator's perspective, so the users downloaded the app, they've integrated it to their bank accounts, and they can generate this income statement or affordability statement. Does this meet, like when the bookie asks for it, does this meet the requirements? Like if they got, you know, if the gaming commission comes in and says, right, show me your files on person XYZ, would they be happy with this, or how does that work?
Yeah, so the Gambling Commission has said that they're perfectly happy for gambling operators to use third-party services to source the data and to perform the analysis. I mean, which obviously they would be, because that's what happens with KYC, right? So when I input my name and address to register for an operator, I don't get sent the credit file by Equifax or whoever. I just get told what the result is. And so we built this tool with that in mind. So an operator has got an audit trail of, you know, for example, the number of bank accounts that were shared. And we have, because we have access to the data, if to the source data, if there's ever a regulatory inquiry, we can always go back and look at the data. But we actually delete the information as soon as we're done processing it, because, you know, people's bank account data is like kind of data kryptonite. You really don't want to be holding it at any point. And so, you know, we kind of try to balance security with auditability. But there's no reason at all why an operator would find, well, why a regulator, sorry, would refuse or reject the analysis. And there's no reason at all to imagine that this is in any way inferior to doing it by hand.
Got it. And because obviously then it could be like if your tool, yeah, like Equifax is a great example, right? So it does the heavy lifting. So because operators don't have teams of people calculating people's credit scores and stuff like that, right? Or like looking up the electoral rolls and these kind of things. So actually, the tool does the heavy lifting. You can get a reliable score that's audible, auditable. So this sounds like, so basically then I'm guessing operators are beating down your door to get integrated and get going, or like how does, what's next for you guys?
Yeah, so we started conversations with operators. We've actually got a couple now who have already agreed to start using it. And we're rolling it out. I mean, you know, you do come across some who say, well, who are effectively in denial, you know, and they say, no, we don't have a problem. You know, they've internalized that cost as far as they're concerned. And that's okay. Because I think what's going on here is that we are trying to change the way that the industry thinks about affordability, rather than just saying, hey, here's a new tool that you can use. Because it's, I mean, anybody who's been around, I'll sound like an old man now, but anyone who's been around long enough to remember, this is what happened when mandatory ID verification first came in. So, you guys, Vincent, you probably, in fact, I'm sure you remember this because there was a time when it was optional. And so nobody did it because the argument was, well, if I'm the only casino that's asking people to give us a copy of their driver's license, I'm not going to have any customers because customers will always go to the operator with the least friction. And then when you'll remember when the conversation started about mandating ID verification, it was driven actually mostly by the payment card industry because of fraud. There was this sort of, oh, the sky's going to fall in on us because no one will ever agree to do it. But of course, now nobody thinks twice about it, right? Because it's expected. And so the whole thing has been normalized. And players appreciate that gambling companies are asking for this because they have to make sure that nobody under the age of 18 is gambling. And they're okay with that. Affordability, I think, is going through the same process of going from being the exception to the rule. Now, whether or not the government comes out with, a soft limit, you know, such as has been suggested by some of the, you know, people at Social Market Foundation, and says you have to set a limit of X. And you have to then check everyone for affordability, whether or not they do that. I think that what's going to happen is that the pressure on operators to maintain affordability knowledge on their players is going to be irresistible for all sorts of reasons, ethical, investor pressure, the works, you know, you name it. But also, frankly, no one's going to want to work in an operator that actually doesn't look after its customers. So that's how it's going to happen. And I think that solutions like this, not just ours, we're not going to have the monopoly, of course. But solutions like this are inevitable and going to have to be part of the process. And that, I don't know how long that's going to take, probably a few years. But we're in the early stages of educating the market that this is even possible, because most people are pretty surprised that it's even you're even able to do this.
Well, I think there's two things here. So, you know, the original statistic he gave of like 2 out of 10 people actually send in the documents. So anything that, you know, the industry is built on conversion rates effectively, right? So anything that shifts that number upwards is a good thing for the business. And then the second thing is when we look at things like single customer view, if you're trying to take a single customer view across, we had Melanie Ennis on last week talking about this in the UK. If you're trying to coordinate people's spend across multiple bookmakers, affordability is actually, so it's not just like, okay, he's spending 100 quid with William Hill and he's spending 100 quid with Paddy Power. Is that affordable or not? Is the next question you have to ask as part of it. So anything that automates that and makes it as simple as possible.
Yeah. The right customer answer. Yeah, I think the single customer view as it's currently expressed is kind of out of date. And it's out of date because of open banking. Because of the credit card ban, pretty much all of gambling spend is going through someone's bank account at some point. I mean, even if you're using PayPal, it still appears on your statement because they're not allowed to preload funds for gambling. So it's effectively all coming through the account. So the bank account is the single customer view that matters. The idea of aggregating everybody's wagering, you're absolutely right. It doesn't tell you whether they can afford it or not, just tells you what the number is. Well, you know, if I've got access to someone's bank accounts, I've got the answer to that already. And nobody has to build this sort of Death Star system where every single gambling operator is expected to feed every player's piece of personal information into them. I mean, the complexity of that system, let alone the error rate that you're going to get in trying to cross-match people in a country like the UK where we don't have a national ID card, I just don't see it ever working. But I don't think it's necessary anymore because open banking solves the problem.
There's a lot of questions. Even I'm coming up with questions here, right?
Even you.
Yeah. And so, also, I think we should have national ID cards in the UK because how else are you going to crush enemies of the state?
Shut off your Facebook accounts.
Oh, no, where do you start? So are you familiar with the Crack Labs report that we've talked about a bit on here in the last couple of weeks?
I'm afraid I'm not.
Well, it went into the data collection and naughtiness of, was it Skybet, Fintan?
Skybet was the subject of the report. What was being reported, just in their defense, is not unique to Skybet. It was just standard.
No, not at all. They've totally been scapegoated in a big way.
Yeah, they've been thrown under the bus with that one.
But at its heart, if they had actually just looked at the bit that was wrong, that did involve affordability checks. It involved the way that was assessed. Because they had this dude's his mortgage information and stuff, if I remember correctly. I guess what I'm asking, Charles, is there a way for this to kind of integrate with, you know, good problem gambling software, with good AI software to strengthen significantly the player protection aspect of this? Or is it innate in the model that you're suggesting anyway?
No, we see what we're doing as an ingredient in the solution, not the whole solution. It absolutely needs to be integrated into people's analytics of gameplay, deposit frequency. There are people out there now doing AI models that look at transcripts of customer service call center interactions and look for words that might indicate distress and so on. And, you know, this could easily become part of that process. And I think responsible operators are going to have to tie all of the pieces together with various bits of technology to look at different aspects of the player life cycle and interaction. Especially if
just for the record,
yeah, go on.
Responsible operators, which is all of them. Sorry, carry
yes.
on.
Yes. Okay. yeah.
So yes, who signed up for your thing then?
I mean, you said you've got a couple of companies. I would love to tell you that, but we've agreed not to. No, we've agreed not to. Yeah.
Who is it?
I think what I'm hoping is that it will work for them and they will want to talk about it.
Can you give us their initials?
No.
yeah. Can we do it like a game of hand?
Good try. Good try. I mean, honestly, your skills as an interrogator are just second to none.
Dazzling, right?
Does it rhyme with butter?
Does it rhyme with B.O. Vegas?
This is like a kind of live Wordle, isn't it?
You should have said, "Is it like no, a fairy, no, no. is it? I can't believe it's not Flutter." Sorry, I'll get my coat.
Of course, you're under strict NDAs until they've proven the technology. Of course,
Vinton knows all about NDAs since he sold it.
I do. You wouldn't believe what I'm not allowed to say anymore.
So
in terms of from the consumer perspective, is your app in the App Store or how does that work?
Yes. So we're in the App Store, Google and Apple, having some interesting conversations with them because they don't quite understand that it's not actually a gambling app. But that's, just this is the penalty you pay for being first at something. And we're going to put some money behind promoting the Bet Budget brand. Because it's all about establishing trust, you've got to get that all-important Trustpilot score and people need to see that this is independent of the gambling industry and it's not making judgments, it's just doing a calculation, which is super, super important.
Interestingly, we're available for podcast sponsorship, but we're not for sale.
Or Trustpilot reviews, whatever you want, man.
yeah, seriously.
We'll go on Amazon. You can bash out thousands of them.
Seriously, I've got nothing else to do. It sounds awesome. It sounds too good to be true. Do you know what I mean? It sounds so good that. The question I really want to ask is, why hasn't anybody done this already?
Do you know what? That's a really good question.
I knew I'd get one.
yeah, well done. It's only taken about half an hour. There's a couple of reasons why it's not been done before. One is because actually until very recently, it just wasn't really viable, wasn't possible, because open banking was really, really immature. You could have gone to an open banking provider, someone like a TrueLayer, and they could have offered you what is essentially a generic credit scoring model for categorization of someone's income. But it would have taken you months to integrate it. I mean, it just wouldn't work, right? Because it doesn't meet the requirement of the industry, or there wouldn't have been enough banks, or the banks were flaky and connections and all this kind of stuff. So it really wasn't viable until recently. The second reason why no one's done it is I just think that RegTech is a kind of a backwater when it comes to innovation. Nobody sees it as a product category. They see it as just a pain in the ass that you have to do. And it's not really worthy of anyone's attention. And I'm a product person and I looked at this and thought, well, if you treat this like a product, you could do something really fantastic. And I think that's probably why it's just a question of time. And I'm sure there are other people working on similar type solutions out there. And I hope they come to market because, we need there to be more awareness of this type of solution.
And I think Charles has been too polite, John, because the gambling industry as a whole is very slow to innovate. and particularly in areas like this. You know, like Charles said at the beginning, he spent how many years standing on his own with a couple of others talking to people about mobile slot games, which was, you know, the biggest no-brainer. It was obvious. when you look at things like...
somebody in IGT, it wasn't O'Shaughnessy. Somebody in IGT once said to me the best thing, most insightful thing I've ever heard about the gambling industry. He said, the problem with this industry is that nobody wants to be first, but nobody wants to be the last.
That is worthy of tattooing permanently on our flesh.
It really is good, isn't it? And it's
so
true.
I think the three of us, I mean, like the Lord of the Rings cast, we can all get the same tattoo in the same place, same font, obviously. But yes, that's wonderfully true. But I think that's one of the reasons why the existence of tribal gaming in the US is such a fantastic, and I really, really hate this word, such a fantastic disruptor in terms of technology in the industry. Because all the really interesting new stuff is always trialed at tribal casinos because they're willing to take a punt on things. They're willing to have a look and say, do you know what? If it does do that, fuck it. Let's give it a go. Without tribal gaming, I think we'd be, well, still be using coin in, coin out, and probably those crappy carpet sweeping things instead of vacuum cleaners.
Yeah. Although I don't know, do you know what? I think I'm going to challenge that one a little bit. Because Tito, which was really the most, probably the most important innovation in slots in the last 20 years.
Yeah.
You know, ticket in, ticket out, which got rid of coins, was actually, I think it was Tom Mikulich, who, if you haven't had on the podcast, you absolutely must do. The guy really is a legend. He was the guy that pushed that. I think he must have been at, he was either at Red Rock or MGM at the time. And he told me once exactly the same thing. He says, like nobody wanted to do this, and IGT had it, or they had the technology, and they implemented it and got it through the Gaming Commission. And before you knew it, everyone said, well, obviously this is the solution. And within, you know, a matter of a couple of years, there were no coin-operated machines left.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, in a mature market, as you know, at that point, most of the US was, you know, it was like as gambling as it could be. In a mature market, the only way to increase profit generally is efficiency. And Tito is an absolutely staggering efficiency. I mean, it's mind-blowing how much money it saves, how much time it saves. And when you look at how products have developed now, if you look at the stuff that JCM have got, if you look at what CPI have got for everything being integrated, you know, in terms of doing your cash drops and all that, it's like, it's stunning now. And it all came from that one step.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's an enabling technology. Again, what was interesting about it is, to some extent, there was nothing new in it. You know, the industry didn't have to invent optical character recognition or barcode scanning. It just had to take technology that had been invented for some other purpose, i.e. shopping, supermarkets, and adapt it to the requirements of the casino industry.
Yeah.
And that's what's really interesting, is that the gaming industry, although it says, people say, oh, it's not innovative, it is actually highly innovative, but it's not original. So we don't do basic research because we don't have to.
Yep. I totally agree with that.
Well, I can't disagree, because, I mean, Charles is on as the expert. Well, also, he knows more than me.
I do.
Charles, Rhonda Whitaker, another superstar, works at IGT.
Yes, indeed. Very much so.
So, Charles, your first ever paid job in the whole world was as a speechwriter. Is that correct?
That is correct. For a Liberal Democrats MP in 1992, I started, and it was a formative experience, shall we say, spending 3 years in the House of Commons, writing speeches for him, people like Paddy Ashdown. And you know, actually, interestingly, during the passage of the National Lottery Act, which was my first exposure to the gambling industry, so I got to know the business. Absolutely fascinating stuff. Don't know, it's all gone downhill since then.
But 3 years is a long time. It's a long time to spend in politics. What do you think, looking back, what did you learn from that you've taken forward? Is there anything? And I appreciate this is a question slightly from left field, but like speech writing, you know, it's a pretty niche field, I would have thought. I wouldn't think there's a lot of professional speech writers out there.
Honestly, I have used the skills that I picked up in that job pretty much every day since then. And it's all about communication. So when you've got somebody who has to stand up in front of a hall of thousands, I mean, literally thousands of people, and make a speech about a very complex policy area in a way that's going to make them understand, agree with you, change people's minds, that is a very challenging prospect. People have been trying to figure it out since the ancient Greeks, and writing about how to do it. And to my surprise, I found in business that actually the ability to do the same thing, even in a small group, whether you're talking to employees or customers or investors, or in fact, turning up at a conference or sitting on a panel, which I used to do a lot of, requires very, very similar skill set and understanding of how to communicate to a room. And it's not something that most people ever learn how to do systematically. You just sort of either can do it or can't and do it on the job. And we've all sat through some really, really awful conference speeches and presentations in our time. And you know a bad one when you see it, but a good one is very, very hard to do.
Here's the question then. We've all seen The West Wing. Was it as sexy and glamorous being a speechwriter in the House of Commons as they made it look like in The West Wing?
Oh, it was absolutely as glamorous. It really was. It was quite something, especially if you're a politics nerd. I mean, it's not the thick of it, okay? That's just nonsense. It's really West Wing stuff.
It's totally believable.
Amazing moments.
Would you ever begin a speech with, unaccustomed as I am to public speaking?
Not if I ever wanted to say another speech ever again.
See, I'm determined that if I ever do any public speaking, that I'm going to roll it with that.
You can actually use that line. So the first thing you should, we're turning this podcast into how to write speeches, right? But the first thing you have to do is get the audience on your side. That's number one job, right? If you haven't done that by the end of the first couple of sentences, you've lost before you've even started. And if you get introduced by somebody who says, this person is a great, you know, gives great speeches and blah, 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 and really talks you up, then you could use that line ironically to poke fun at yourself. And that will put the audience on your side straight away. But you've got to be really confident that you can do those sorts of jokes. Because if it comes across wrong, you're going to look like a real twat and no one's going to listen to a thing you say for the next 20 minutes.
Brilliant. Well, I've got it sorted then.
That's why we script this podcast.
No, it's the only safe way, Fintan. Very, very careful scripting and working on timing.
And editing as well. There was a great moment last week where you left in the me answering the hotel door. Negotiating my room for the next night.
I really did enjoy it.
Which was a nice surprise on my run on Saturday.
I think it's nice that you keep it real.
We definitely keep it real.
It's the only way. Listen, the remit when we started doing this was We want to do a podcast where we're not selling anything, where we're just finding interesting stuff and we're talking about what's interesting, what's going on. And it has personality and it's not dull. And I think we've achieved many of those things.
Up until today.
No, you've been fantastic.
I could not possibly comment.
You've been fantastic. Well, we've definitely rolled back on the advertising. We're totally for sale. That was stupid.
But did you note the bipolarity there? You're like, oh no, you've been terrific. And I can't comment on that. It's a good job you're here, Fintan, because you know what I'm like. I just dig myself
job on
a
back.
Pit.
Yeah, save the numbers. All right. Charles.
Thank you very much for joining us today. We very much appreciate your company and good luck with the project because it really does sound fantastic. And anybody interested in talking to Charles about this, discussing this with Charles Cohen, you can find him on LinkedIn. And Charles, what's the web address?
It's dotrust, so dotrust.co.uk.
Brilliant.
Sweet. Thank you.
All right. I'm also available for bar mitzvahs and weddings.
That's my other favorite line. Oh, and I'm here.
Annual conferences. Yeah. You're like the Mrs. Maisel of podcasting.
When you're live, please let us know. And you're always welcome back to talk more about this.
Yeah, I'd love to. Thank you very much indeed. I really appreciate it and what you're doing. It's good.
We move on to our second guest. In fact, I think we only have two guests today. But, you know, it's not in a bad way because two is ample when they're of the quality of Charles Cohen, who we just met, and Dr. Michael Auer, who we are about to meet. Dr. Auer, welcome. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Welcome. Thanks for having me.
It's all right. Now, I do need to say, in the interest of full disclosure, Dr. Auer and I do some work together. I work freelance, so I help Michael with press releases and stuff for his company Necton. Dr. Auer is the co-founder and director of Necton, which is a company that specializes in, I suppose the marquee product is Mentor player protection software, but Mentor also has AML modules. You know, there's a lot more to it than the player protection aspect, but that's what it's most famous for. And Dr. Auer's background is in the interesting combination of data science and psychology.
Can I just stop and just roll this back a little bit? This podcast has got an ethics policy where we need to declare interests. I didn't know. When did we introduce this?
Well, it's not a policy as such, and they're not necessarily ethics that we have.
Okay, fine.
It's just, you know, somebody's always there to say, you're only talking to him because... No, we're talking to him because he's a real expert in his field.
Okay, fine. Just making sure there wasn't some sort of executive decision while I was away and things have changed because...
No, Christ, no. I mean, well, we're fairly transparent, I think.
We're too transparent. That's the problem.
We're just keeping our shit real.
Yeah. Sorry. I've completely digressed.
No.
Go ahead.
No, but you know, valuable question, and I appreciate that. But it's also clarified things for both of our listeners. Should I call you Dr. Auer? Should I call you Michael? Should I call you, you know,
Michael Rutger? Michael is good. Rutger. No, Michael is good. Rutger Hauer.
Oh, yeah, he spells
it. Yeah, he's awesome.
What we wanted to talk about today is there's actually an article in the latest Casino International about this, or in GIO, in Gaming International Online, which is within Casino International, about AI and problem gambling. And I know, you know, both things that you're passionate about and that you are a world renowned expert on. Now, can you give us a little bit of background in AI? Like, where did it come? I mean, it didn't just grow in somebody's garden, did it? There is an evolution to it. So where did it start and where are we now?
All right. How much time do we have? Well, I think
three years.
Okay. I mean, originally, the entire idea of artificial intelligence came was invented, or that the term itself was invented sometime, I think, in the 1950s. And that's also, I think, what I mentioned in the article that just came out. And back then, of course, just like now, the idea was that you have a system which, I mean, behaves like a human, right? That was the original idea. And it actually goes back even further with, you know, robots, which comes, I think it's a Czech word actually originally. It goes back to, you know, like machines, automated machines in the late 20th century, when, you know, they actually had a person in those machines, like, you know, moving levers, and it made the impression of being, you know, an artificial whatever robot person. And that's the original original fascination that people had with it. You know, can there be something which is not human, but it sort of behaves like a human? And to this day, AI, the word itself makes, you know, the assumption that you have an artificial, like a non-biological thing, entity, which behaves in an intelligent way. And then in the 1950s, for the first time, you know, they had computers, and they had they invented actually the neural network, which is a type of algorithm back then. And that sort of gave rise to the idea that you could, you know, use data and process data and outcomes, a rule, and that, you know, rule engine. And this is so flexible that it can basically predict, can basically explain everything. But it didn't work because the neural network algorithms back then simply had a problem which is too complicated now to explain. So all of that really went dormant for a number of years. And then the term AI came back sometime in the late 1980s, in the 1990s, and there's also the Steven Spielberg movie AI. When is this from? I think sometime from the 90s, with, you know, the boy which sort of behaved like a human but was actually a machine. But ultimately, if we think about it, it's statistics, right? So like you mentioned before, I'm a data scientist, yes, but originally I studied like really statistics. That's, you know, what I got my master's in. So, and let's imagine we have a group of people, and we know everybody's height, and we can compute the average height. Let's say the average height is, I don't know, 170 centimeters. I refer now to centimeters because I'm not so familiar with feet and inches. Right?
It's okay. We're a multicultural
podcast. We're multicultural, yeah. So let's say we have a group of 100 people and the average height is 172 centimeters. So now we additionally learn or can identify the 100 people's gender. We have females, we have males, and maybe, you know, other genders in the group. And then we measure we measure the height, and then, you know, we compute the average height for females and the average height for males. And then we find out that the females are a little bit, you know, shorter than the males. So what did I learn now? So before, I had one metric, like the average across everybody, that, you know, I could use to describe this group of people. I could say, the typical person in my sample, in my group, is 1.72 centimeters, right? 172 centimeters. And if I, you know, describe every individual with that metrics, of course, some of them are taller, some of them are smaller. And if I compute like the difference between everybody's height and this average metric, we call this in statistics the bias. We call it, you know, the measurement error. And I can compute this measurement error. However, if I compute the female's average height and the male's average height, and then I compute the error, you know, with with those metrics within the females and within the males, the error will be smaller, right? Because the female average height is more similar to the typical female's height, and the male's average height is more similar to the typical male's height. So my measurement error is smaller. I learned something, so I improved my prediction, my model to describe that population of humans. Is that somehow clear?
Very clear.
Yeah. So, and then I can go beyond that. So I can, you know, try to measure other metrics that might be correlated with height, you know, nutrition, age, you know, country, you know, a birth country. We know, you know, people in the Nordics are taller than people in the South, all sorts of things. So the more metrics I collect, the more, you know, accurate my model will describe the data. And of course, there will be metrics like the star sign, the zodiac, whatever you want to call it, will not be correlated. The color of the hair might not be correlated, things like that, right? But I can try to figure out, you know, as many metrics as possible to improve my, you know, my statistical model. That's AI. You know, I mean, that's basically I have data and I try to explain the real world with data. And the more data I have, the better I'm able to explain, you know, the real world, my sample. And in a nutshell, this is what AI is. This is what machine learning is. That's statistical models. So there's not really any difference, except that, you know, a machine learning and an AI model will become, you know, more complex. You take into account more variables, you apply, you know, more sophisticated mathematical models. But in a nutshell, that's about it. And of course, every company, organization having data will try to explain the data with, you know, underlying models. And if it's just, you know, the average, if it's just, you know, okay, I have an Excel spreadsheet and, you know, I compute, I don't know, the average amount wagered, the average amount deposited for, I don't know, players who registered, you know, last month compared to players who registered 3 years ago, for players who registered via mobile phone compared to players who registered via this, via that, et cetera, et cetera. So that's one important aspect when it comes to AI. So let's now talk a little bit about AI as a method, as an instrument to understand problem gambling.
Okay.
Okay.
Oh, you're waiting for me?
No. I will continue. All right. So
I'm going to jump in. Sorry. Add something.
Go ahead.
That's the first. So I've heard AI being used as AI and blockchain get used as a buzzword for everything. Oh, we're using AI to solve this problem. Mm-hmm. This is the first time I've had a proper common sense look. This is what it actually is. And obviously, you know, as you add more variables, it gets more complicated. So I know, I understand that the complexity ratchets up pretty quickly, but it's just like, oh, I understand it. And then it's a case of, well, if your data is shitty, your AI is shitty. So it's really all about your data and how clean and precise your data is. Mm-hmm. As best, obviously within reason, but as best as possible. Is that a fair assumption?
Yeah, that's a fair assumption. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I understand. Sorry. Okay. Go ahead. So AI and problem gambling.
Exactly.
How are you guys
on? Okay. All right. So first of all, we have to keep in mind or recollect what makes a problem gambler, right? So what are, you know, criteria for problem gambling? So let's say if John would, you know, consult his doctor, his, you know, a GP, his psychologist, his psychiatrist, his neurologist, and because he, you know, he suspects that he has a problem with gambling or, I don't know, anything else, anything, you know, mental, then the doctor would, you know, pick a manual from the shelf, which, for example, is called the DSM, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. And it's basically a big book with rules. I mean, ultimately, it's also an algorithm, right? And there are, in for gambling, there are nine, you know, criteria, nine items. And those nine items are defining, you know, what sort of what criteria have to be present for somebody to be a problem gambler. And then it's, you know, up to the doctor, to the clinician, to decide if you meet those criteria, and if you meet, you know, a certain number of criteria, then you are, from a clinical point of view, a problem gambler. So those are, for example, needs to gamble with increasing amounts of money. That's called tolerance, right? So in drug use, if you use, you know, like abuse substances, then, you know, you need to consume more and more to build up, you know, the same sort of same amount of, you know, satisfaction, right? You need to drink more, you need to use more, whatever, a drug. And for gambling, it's the same. Or is restless or irritable when attempting to cut down or stop on the gambling. And so withdrawal symptoms. So, and some of those criteria we can imagine to reflect in gambling data, right? So wagering, depositing, things like that. So needs to gamble with increasing amount of money. We can imagine if I monitor a player's behavior over a period of time and I see that the player, you know, gambles more and more, I could, you know, sort of regard this as meeting the criterion. Others are, for example, relies on others to provide money to relieve a desperate financial situation caused by gambling. So what typically operators do then is that they check, you know, how many payment accounts do you use, how many credit cards is somebody using, how many bank accounts do they regularly add, you know, new sources of payment, and also are the payments, you know, coming through, or are they failing because of insufficient funds, things like that. And then there are other criteria, like is restless or irritable when attempting to cut down or stop gambling. It's hard to spot something like that because it's a cognitive, you know, it's a psychological, it's sort of a state of mood, right? So the gambling operator can monitor actual, you know, behavior, depositing within sessions, things like that, and try to, you know, detect as many of those criteria. And coming back to your question before, Fintan, and it's about the quality of the data. And typically, those data are of high quality, right? Objective, we call it, you know, account-based data or player tracking data, how much they wager, how much they deposit, withdraw. So in total, some of the clinical criteria can be observed or measured with objective player tracking data. Others will always be always be concealed from the operator because they are simply within the individual. They are, you know, psychological criteria, like has jeopardized or lost a significant relationship, job or career because of gambling. So that's important to keep in mind when we talk about the detection, you know, of or prediction of problem gambling. So as an operator can never detect or predict problem gambling from a clinical point of view. Mm-hmm. An operator can always only detect indications of problematic gambling. And I'm always careful about the wording. I never say problem gambling, but always say problematic gambling, right? Because the operator can only see indications of problematic gambling. So what typically operators do, they monitor metrics like depositing within session, because that can be a strong indication of chasing losses, of impulsivity. If a player regularly, you know, deposits multiple times within sessions, or a player gambles, the balance comes down to zero, they deposit again to continue gambling, and ultimately at the end of the session their account is always depleted or almost depleted, right? So those are metrics they are monitoring. Then, you know, changes over time, failed deposits, withdrawals, etc., etc. So that's a so-called, you know, set of markers of harm that I believe, you know, most operators, including us, are monitoring constantly. And based on those criteria, you know, they classify players and then, you know, put them into segments. And that's, you know, what we call an unsupervised algorithm, because you don't learn from past data. I mean, you have rules, you apply those rules, and then you classify the players. The other approach is to visit or call, you know, use past data and label those data. So let's say, let's take maybe a different example. So let's say I had data of people who had a certain type of cancer for, you know, the last 5 years. So I have a sample of, let's say, 1,000 people, and I know at which point of time cancer was diagnosed via, I don't know, CT or something like that. And additionally, I know for all those 1,000 people, all the examinations, blood work, you know, blood pressure, other CTs, examinations before they had this examination and cancer was diagnosed. So what I can do then is I can take all the data prior to the diagnosis, you know, the more history I have, the better, and that I can try to find out what kind of conditions are predictive of a person to be diagnosed of a certain type of cancer or other disease in the near future. And that's something that we call, that's a supervised model. A supervised model means that you have to have a labeled data. So you have to know which one of those, you know, of people in my sample or records or data records showed a certain condition. The same is, for example, for fraud. So if I knew, okay, those were my fraud, a bank knew, that's, you know, they have collected all the fraud, past fraud cases in the database of the last 5 years, then they can take the data of those accounts before and try to predict which data are predictive of fraud.
Crikey.
Is that clear so far or too complicated?
I think my brain has probably slightly melted, but luckily Fintan's here and he's far smarter than I am.
It makes perfect. It's beauty in the brains here. That makes perfect sense, right? So you can gather all the data, use past outcomes to make more accurate predictions or to help people who are making decisions make better decisions.
Exactly.
Which in a responsible gambling situation is okay. So we've got all these markers that says there's a problem. We've just spoken with Charles Cohen about like affordability checks.
Yeah.
You overlay some affordability check data, some other, I don't know, maybe a phone call with a VIP manager or a staff member and the kind of denotes from that. And then it becomes a much more joined up, decision-making process to say, actually, on balance, we think this person's okay. Or more likely, look, there's definitely needs to be some sort of intervention. Let's say I'm an operator who's listening to this and go, this all makes sense, but you haven't seen my back end. It's a mess and, you know, integrate. Like, how easy or difficult is it to, like, work with your software? Like, what does that process look like?
Yeah. So, I mean, I, from the beginning, you know, since I started to think about that topic in the late 2000s, I thought, I mean, you can do something, you know, beyond, which is, you know, in my opinion, far more valuable than, you know, sort of identifying problematic gambling. I mean, problematic gambling is a necessity. The identification of problematic gambling, of course, is a necessity, but you can do something way before somebody develops a problem or, you know, pops up as a problem gambler. And that's personalized interactions. So very early on, we thought about, you know, personalization, because that also you know, stems from us, from me working a lot in CRM and in marketing before, where it's all about, you know, communication. It's all about nudging somebody into a certain direction. So what we did is, or what we do is that we try to communicate with the player via, you know, messages. So let's say you see, you know, somebody is, you know, losses, you know, increase, depositing frequency decreases. Then you provide a message to the player via, you know, the gambling side, you know, in a non-judgmental way, informing the player, okay, look, we've observed, you know, there's the opposite. The posting has increased, etc. Would you like to visit, you know, the reality check page or update your deposit limits? So that's something which is really important for us, and that our system, our software does basically out of the box. So it personalizes the communication, not only with the problem player, but with all players who show, you know, behavioral changes or extreme things in their behavior. And then the second step is, of course, the interaction, and that's already something that you know that goes in hand with the communication. So it's easy for the operator working with our system to, you know, communicate with the player, to, you know, note the outcome of the communications. A lot of operators include then source of wealth information, so they purchase source of wealth information from various operator providers, and it turns out to be very really important that the operators, you know, one system, whatever this system is, that they can use to collect all the information to really get a good, you know, as complete as possible overview of a player's behavior.
That makes sense. How, so the early intervention stuff is I'm a big fan of, because obviously it's trying to catch things before it becomes a problem, right? That's the ideal. How effective are nudges, or how effective are nudges? Like, does it mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Does it help?
Yeah, we published a number. I mean, at least 10 academic studies with real world players where we solely focused on the nudging, on the personalized feedback, right? You know, like providing the text messages, then monitoring the player's behavior change. For example, we also published a study where players received a reminder when they had used 80% of the limit. So then they received a reminder, and we also found that to be very useful for players really to, you know, sort of control their gambling, not to sort of hit the limit, or, you know, in worst case, basically exceed the limit. What we also found is that in the beginning, so before, you know, in 2013 or 12, when I published my first sort of pop-up study, because the other sort of way to communicate is actually that there is a pop-up on the site in real time, which, you know, informs a player about a certain type of behavior. And there are a couple of studies which investigated, you know, such pop-ups in a laboratory setting. So imagine, I mean, you recruit 20, 30, 40, 50, you know, students from campus. They sit in front of a computer, they play, you know, on a simulated environment, they receive a pop-up message, do they stop to gamble or not? And those laboratory studies, of course, had very favorable outcomes. So most, you know, participants stopped to gamble when a pop-up appeared and told them, you have now spent, I don't know, 80% of the $10 that we gave you. Do you want to keep those $2 or do you want to continue gambling? And then we made a study, real world, with real online casino, and players received a pop-up message after 1,000 slot games played, which is roughly 1 hour of continuous gambling. And it told the players, you've just played 1 hour. Would you like to, you know, continue or stop? And what percent of players do you think stopped to gamble after they saw this pop-up message?
10%.
105.
No, 0.69%. And so out of 100,000 players who gambled for an hour, seven players actually stopped after, you know, seeing this pop-up. So I was, of course, quite disappointed because I thought the effect would be higher. So it turns out that, you know, pop-ups while gambling, if not done in a sort of certain way, have very low effect on players stopping to play. So then what we did is when operators, you know, display pop-up messages, of course, they can only do this if you have a real-time, you know, machine running. So if the operator is able to stream the data in real time, you take a decision. So, and now we add, for example, links into the pop-up messages. So a pop-up message comes up, ask the player, you know, blah, blah, blah. You have now gambled for an hour. Would you like to, you know, do a reality check? Would you like to, for example, you know, withdraw some of the money, etc.? And there we see really, you know, bigger effects. So quite significantly people clicking on those links. So you see, you know, they're more interactive, the easier it is for the player to click on something, the more likely they're going to do it, right? So if it's just a text, not trying to nudge the player to do a certain thing without the link, you can be almost certain that they're just going to ignore it. But as soon as something is flashing, as soon as they're a link, it's much more likely for them to click on it.
That's really interesting because it interrupts the flow with something to
exactly,
do, right?
Exactly, exactly. And then, you know, another thing which is interesting, which is, of course, also part of the AI, part of the technology, is that somehow, you know, the industry decided, I don't know who, you know, made them do it. I mean, I have sort of one suspect here that it makes that, you know, that they should display or they should introduce a play break for 90 seconds after 1 hour of consecutive play. So there are quite a few operators. I think it's also tied to certain RG certifications, and they block the player for 90 seconds after 1 hour of consecutive play. But nobody really ever questioned whether this is useful. And in worst case, and some researchers, they suspected or they hypothesized that players might even gamble more after the 90 seconds because it builds up craving, right?
Mm. Yeah, yeah. You see it in mobile games, right, where they kick
exactly.
you out after
yeah, exactly. 15 so, minutes. Yeah. Then not long ago, we did like a natural experiment. So one operator was kind enough and let us experiment with their players. And we thought, okay, we have one group of players and they are going to be blocked for 90 seconds. Another group of players, they are going to be blocked for 5 minutes. Another group of players, they are going to be blocked for 15 minutes. So we wanted to find out what makes more sense. And our, you know, objective, our metric was how long does it take for a player to come back on the site after the block is over, right? Do they come back right after or does it take, you know, whatever? So what do you think is, you know, players, how long does it, do you think typically take for players to come back and, you know, start gambling again after they have been blocked for 90 seconds?
Straight away.
Exactly. So less than a minute. The same for 5 minutes. And we saw a large difference between, you know, 95 and, on the other hand, 15 minutes. So those players came back on average, you know, 7 minutes after their play break was over. So that was really large difference with respect to the interruption that was, you know, caused by the pop-up. So it takes at least 15 minutes for somebody to change the activity.
Did they make up for the lost time?
Nah, so that's also now important. So what we also did is we we checked whether players who lost more before the play break also gambled more after, right? So if they tried to win back the losses. Exactly. So if there was a correlation between losing before the play break and the intensity of gambling afterwards. We didn't find that. So we falsified basically, you know, the hypothesis that the play break would cause, you know, chasing behavior.
Did their bet size change?
No.
Because no, okay. Mm-mm. That's interesting. I would have bet they would have.
Yeah.
Just to kind of point to
principle. I mean, of course, that was just one study. I mean, two studies.
Yeah, sure.
Right? So those things need to be replicated in different environments. Who knows, you know, it also might depend on the platform. How easy is it, you know, to deposit, you know, things like that.
Indeed. That's really fascinating. So what's your recommendation? Like, what does best practice look like?
In terms of what?
Everything. Fixing everything.
Well, it's a really interesting question, because if you take so I've watched some of the stuff from the DeepMind guys in the UK. So they got bought by Google, super smart guys, and they, you know, solved Go, and they've solved, you know, video games and all this kind of stuff. And their whole mission is to solve for intelligence and then solve everything else. And obviously, you know, when you're backed by Google, it's easy to be ambitious. So the question for you is, like, can you solve for a problem gambling?
Good question.
Well, I mean, we're here to pose the big question. Well, Fintan's here to pose the big questions.
Well, I mean, I think what makes a huge difference is the transparency towards the player. And I'd say best practice, or what every operator should do, is to, you know, display as much information to players in an as easy accessible way as possible, you know, preferably when they log in, show players, you know, how much they played, how much they lost. And of course, I mean, what we see now in some of the studies and studies before have shown that the ease of depositing plays really a huge role here. So depositing within session really, you know, can be a big issue for problem players, for impulsive players. Of course, there's a trade-off, right, between, you know, the commercial side and, you know, the other side. But if you see players depositing frequently and you have, you know, other indications that, because it's never just one, you know, type of behavior, there have to be several types of behavior, you know, to be indicative of problematic gambling, then, you know, I think operators should have the technical setup to, you know, limit players with respect to, you know, how easy they can actually really, you know, transfer money.
So you can solve a problem gambling, is what you're saying? And I know you're a scientist.
There's always a spectrum of behavior, right? I mean, you will always have tall people, you have smaller people, you have brighter people, you have less brighter people. You will have, you know, addicts to whatever, you know.
There's nothing wrong with being stupid and short.
And you'll always have problem gamblers, you know. I mean, that's something that will never sort of be eradicated. But, I'm pretty sure you can create more problem gamblers if you provide your product in a, you know, very unsafe way, right? I mean, you can easily cause or create, you know, trigger, you know, push somebody over the edge if your product is offered, you know, in a certain way without any of the safeguards. You know, if you have things like mandatory play breaks, you know, breaks between, I don't know, you know, maximum, you limit, you know, the speed of play, sort of you have limitations with respect to the number, the frequency of deposits, you know, a credit card, etc., etc. Then I think there's a good chance that, you know, you will prevent some people of developing an issue with gambling.
It makes sense because when you, because the thing is the industry does have a lot of safeguards and a lot of rules it needs to abide by. I think where you actually see this pushing people over the edge is in the mobile gaming space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like the game mechanics built into a typical app these days is horrific. I've had to like intervene with my son on occasions on stuff.
Yeah.
Like, and like literally sit down with him and explain and show him how like the app is trying to trick him.
Yeah.
Or get him hooked. But you know, you could easily imagine a very brave CEO turning to you and saying, Michael, I don't want any problem gamblers in my business. Help me make sure that doesn't happen. Because I agree with your point. There's, you know, we've had a lot of like problem gambling experts on, on the treatment side of things. And it's always a treatment requires a holistic approach. It's typically problem gambling is typically a symptom of something else. And it's a very complicated, it's not just that, you know, you like playing slots too much. There's other problems that, and this is how it manifests. So you'll never get rid of it. But there is a scenario where a CEO could say, look, actually, we don't want any money from problem gamblers or anybody with a problem, a gambling problem. Help us make that happen. Would that be an easier brief than solving problem gambling?
Yeah, I mean, if you sort of, I mean, of course, you could never know. Somebody could play in a non-problematic way with you because they simply can't, execute, you know, that behavior because you have those safety measures in place, but still, you know, gamble with you, but gamble problematic in another environment, right? So I think for that reason, it's, you know, probably next to impossible not to have any problem gamblers, but you could sort of, have the safeguards in place that they simply, you know, cannot show that type of problematic behavior because you have the tools. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, it makes perfect sense because,
I am sorry if I always come back to that, but sort of if you really limit somebody's depositing to, you know, once a day or once a session, right? So if their impulsivity, you know, cannot carry them away. So if you intervene as soon as you see, you know, somebody, you know, some their wages are increasing, and they try to, you know, win back losses. They try to make riskier bets. So as if a platform then immediately intervenes, you know, and sort of breaks that sort of, you know, vicious circle, then, you know, I mean, you have a good chance of really, you know, helping players.
Which you could just build it into the product, because like the great example I've always used, and they've been bought recently by Flutter, is Tombola in the UK. So Tombola Bingo.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they've been doing this forever. So they just built into their product, you know, there's maximum stakes, maximum deposit limits, which were by industry standards very low.
Yeah.
And a bunch of other things that they just built in automatically, and just that was it.
Yeah.
And they were, you know, obviously great product, great marketing, a lot of other stuff going on, but they were hands down the number one bingo brand.
Yeah.
And they replicated that in Spain and in Italy many years later. So it wasn't just a one-off thing.
Yeah.
Now
it's interesting what you are saying, because there is actually a lot of discussion about, you know, the player, the problem player metrics, you know, predicting identification of problematic play, but comparably little discussion and next to no research about the product itself, right? So there is one research paper that in the history of research, okay, that actually analyzed features of games, you know, structural characteristics, mm-hmm. within a sample of real-world players. Okay? So one research paper that actually sort of tried to, you know, analyze what, you know, game features in terms of event frequency, RTP, jackpot size, make somebody gamble more or less. And everything else that, you know, we assume is predictive of, you know, gambling intensity is actually based on player panels. So, you know, players been asked, how much do you, I mean, what features do you believe are important for your gambling, blah, 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 things like that.
Which you know, the industry does this instinctively, right? So if you look at the big push for in-play betting in America, it's like educating Americans on in-play sports betting. Like the industry knows what works.
Well, I think to some degree, you know, I think there is knowledge, of course, but nobody really knows why a game is successful. Otherwise, there wouldn't be such a huge amount of game development, right? Nobody has a silver bullet. Nobody can say, I developed this game. It's a medieval topic. It has, you know, collection mode, blah, 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 bonus games. And that's going to be my silver bullet. This is going to be my blockbuster. This is going to be the Lord of the Rings of gambling. Nobody knows, right?
Yeah, look, it's the Starburst example, right? So Starburst is the number one slot game on everybody's homepage.
Yeah.
Or probably not anymore, but it was like there's a few others now since. But
And for example, I mean, we did a research now, and I mean, we submitted that paper back in fall last year. And for the first time in an online casino environment, I tried to correlate structural characteristics with the session length. Yeah. And what do you think, what percent of somebody's spend in a session can be explained by the mathematical aspects of the game they are playing?
100%.
No, 7%.
Really?
Yeah. The rest is something else. You know, I don't know, maybe it's the topic. I mean, you know, I've been sort of, I analyzed basically casino games, right? And they're all pretty similar with respect to event frequency, very similar with respect to hit frequency, very similar with respect to RTP, et cetera, et cetera, right? So those typical metrics that, you know, are suggested to be linked to problematic gambling, first of all, there's very little variation within, you know, the casino games. And secondly, the variation explains very little how long somebody gambles a place on a certain type of game. So maybe it's other things too, you know, like the topic, you know, I mean, you, John, feels attracted to, I don't know, mermaids.
We talked about this off air. We said we weren't going to bring that up.
You feel attracted to, you know, whatever futuristic topics. I feel attracted to penguins, you know. I mean, I don't know, you know, everybody prefers, you know, a certain, you know, somebody might like, I don't know, a certain TV show and be hooked on a slot. Somebody might like a certain, you know, musical genre and be hooked on a game. So it's, I think it's, I mean, or I mean, just, you know, sort of hypothesizing here, but the mathematical aspects explained actually very little. I mean, the ones we've been looking at. And, you know, I mean, there's actually, in my opinion, very little knowledge about what makes a game really more attractive within the realm of casino games. Okay, I can, of course, make the statement, if I can only play this game once a day, it will be very difficult, you know, to spend, I don't know, you know, to sort of, you simply don't have this reinforcement cycle. But any slot I can play 1,000 times an hour, right? Because it's simply how they are made.
Is it the one hypothesis then would be it's your it's a bit like when people ever place their first bet.
Yeah.
So if the first bet you've ever placed in your life is a winner, you're probably going to gamble more for the rest of your life.
That's one assumption. Yeah.
And when we look at the slot games, like if you're within your first session, you've had a relatively good experience. So let's say it's John and his mermaids. Would then that predispose John to future mermaid games, and he's more likely to lose money to mermaid games versus a difference because he's just had a really good experience with that in his first session or first couple of sessions? Is there anything around that?
The early win, I mean, those are things, of course, that stem from, player surveys, right? Whether that reflects in data, I can't say because nobody...
I'd never trust a player survey and stuff like that because it's like if you ask them...
Yeah, look, what we also did is, I mean, in some of our studies, I mean, we ask players, how much do you think you lost? And that's actually also a feature in our software that the players can at any time estimate their own behavior, and then the system tells them that's what you actually did, right? And not surprisingly, we see a large difference between self-reported gambling and actual gambling. And that, of course, supports what you just said. I mean, how can you, you're not aware, right? I mean, you're simply not aware, and it's multidimensional, and maybe, I don't know, you are hooked because, your subconscious remembers, that, you had as a baby a toy which, sounded similar. I mean, who knows,
It's difficult. It's like, in a way, it's kind of the similarity is branding, right? So why do people buy Rolex watches?
Exactly. And that's also, for example, why some of the games, are so popular, simply because they are popular. You know what I mean? It's like, why do you buy a Mercedes? Because you learned that it's a good car, right? Because you knew other people who had it. Because it's simply marketing has pounded it into your brain for decades, and that's also why certain games are popular, have been popular for decades, because it's something that's always been there. I mean, you know it, you're familiar with it, blah blah blah, and that's why you play it, but not naturally, because you could copy that game one to one, analytically, visually, give it a different name, and people wouldn't gamble it because they don't connect the name with the brand.
Yeah, which is why there's so many branded slot games, like The Sopranos and Game of Thrones, and you're just piggybacking.
I won't mention any names, not to make the impression that I'm affiliated with any game developer.
but it goes back to that same thing. So it's like, oh, I like The Sopranos. There's The Sopranos slots. Exactly. I'm going to go play that, right? So it's that, because there's also I think one of the big problems all casinos have is actually discovery. So if you're presented with 500 slot games, you'll pick Starburst because you've heard of it, or you pick, oh, I like that TV show, or so helping with discovery, I think, is a huge issue too. This is fascinating. So, but there was a question I asked earlier on, which was about the nuts and bolts of integration. What would integrating Necton into a platform look like?
Well, on the the nuts and bolts is, of course, the data. So the operator, first of all, has to establish, a data handshake with us. So they send us data, and that's basically every wager, every win, every deposit, every withdrawal, right? The raw data. Mm-hmm. And those data can be exchanged in batch mode, so once a day.
Yep.
Or they can be streamed. I mean, streaming is a popular sort of term for a real-time integration. It's just, technological, more advanced. And then once we have the data, we compute, the metrics, everything else. Then the operator's personnel receive access to a web-based application There they can profile every player. They can make notes. They can make tickets. They can look at their player base, you know, in an aggregated way. How many active players, how many risk players, blah, blah, blah. And then the second part is a player facing component. So most operators integrate a part of our software into their site. And this part of the software is simply a feedback portal for the player. So where players, you know, navigate on to a certain section of the site. They could call it safety center, or for example, some call it, you know, they have like branded names for it. The Canadians, Atlantic Lodge Corporation call it Playwise, and players navigate there. Then they see in an easy, you know, easy accessible way, numbers like how much did I wager, how much did I lose. They see how much they gamble on every day. They can do the aforementioned reality check, the self-assessment. And there they also receive personalized messages. And that's basically populated by us based on the data that we receive. And we also use this information to monitor players. So if you see, let's say John and Fintan gamble the same way, right? Both in a very problematic way. And then Fintan, you know, he reads messages that we send to him. You know, he navigates to the limit page. He does certain things. And John ignores everything, so he sees he got messages, but he doesn't read them. He doesn't navigate to his account statements. And then I argue that Fintan is a more responsible player because at least he doesn't ignore, you know, the recommendations we give to him. So it's really like a closed loop process. You know, it's the data, it's the nudging, and then it's the monitoring of the nudging. Consequences that we use in the, you know, determination in the risk computation for the player.
That's fantastic. Are you allowed to talk about who you work with?
Yeah, sure. So we work with the entire, with the Green Cube group. Are you familiar with them?
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah, so they are, they have licenses in the UK, they have Spain, Switzerland, Germany, and Latvia. Then we also work with, Skill On Net. I'm not sure if you're familiar with them. They have a brand called Play Ocho in the UK. They have Spanish, Swedish, German players. Others are, for example, lots of lotteries. Like we work with the New Zealand Lottery, with the Dutch Lottery, Toto. They are now the largest, I believe, operator, online casino operator in the Netherlands.
They are right now, yeah.
So they use our system. Atlantic Lottery Corporation, the Austrian lotteries, then a number of German lotteries, which are now positioning themselves to also offer online casino games. Kasumo, maybe you've heard of them. They are they have brands all over the place. The Come On Group, they have brands all over, mostly Nordics and Germany. So it's really wide variety of operators, of platforms, and I believe there is. I mean, we cover every Western European country. I guess, of course, we also work with Rikstoto, which is stately, which is a Norwegian stately owned operator. They offer sport, horse betting there. We also work with Play North. They have a brand in the Netherlands. So yeah, so lots of operators, large variety in the product, sports betting, casino, as well as lottery.
So question for you then. I've got a friend who works in the IT security space in the US.
Yeah.
So every time there's a big hacking event that hits the news, their sales phone line just lights up from very concerned CTOs trying to make sure it's not safe. When a big responsible gambling fine gets dished out, do you get a lot of LinkedIn messages?
Yeah, so constantly, basically. So it's Now, so I tell you, it was really difficult from until 2018. So we developed the software in 2011. And then in 2019, I don't know, something changed. I mean, we also changed because we decided that we would scrap our old version technology and exchange it for a newer technology. So our solution runs in the Google Cloud. It uses basically a lot of Google applications. For that reason, I mean, it's really real time. I mean, not joking here. We process 70 billion transactions a year. There are about 150 to 200 sites that stream or send data to our solution. And nowadays, it's really like almost, I mean, once a month or every other week, I'm signing a contract with a new client. And we have basically 15 operators, some of them live in Germany, some waiting to get licenses, the same in the Netherlands. So I think some of the territories, we really process a majority of the population there.
I think the big change was that in 2019, we started working together.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Now, of course, it's also word of mouth, right? So I think, I mean, I believe, I'm not, I mean, we never followed the motto, fake it till you make it, because the system really works. There are so many operators using it, and some of them really rely heavily on it because their personnel doesn't have any other system except for ours. So everything they do, we know every decision they make, every document that they screen, everything is done in our back office.
So John has to be very careful with you as a client making claims like it's all him. Because if there's one client who can run the statistical analysis and backtest that statement, it's you, Michael. So every agency tries to claim success when the client does well. But I think he's in over his head on this one. This is fantastic. I've learned so much.
I should say to our listeners as well that in the interest of full disclosure, Michael is not Austrian. He is in fact a robot and the manifestation.
Yeah, I'm the best AI you can
artificial
have.
Artificial intelligence, yeah. It's just, you know. So I hope we've really advertised your artificial intelligence capabilities there. But Michael, thank you very much for joining us. I wanted you to come on when Fintan, you know, could stop shopping for watches and shampooing his hair in very rich shampoos, because I knew that he would enjoy talking data nerdery with you.
All right.
I was quite correct in my hopes there. But thank you so much for joining us. And, you know, I'll talk to you tomorrow probably.
Looking forward. Just, you know, you mentioned before that the article appeared in...
Yeah.
Okay. Super.
It's in the February edition of Casino International, if anybody wants to look for it.
Can you send me a link?
I can, and I can tell the listeners that it's at www.casinointernational-online.com. Mm. Go to the digital issues and look up the February issue, and it's in there. We haven't actually put the article itself online yet, but that's just because I'm slapdash.
Super.
Thanks a lot, Michael.
Thanks for inviting me. It was a very interesting talk. I hope I could shed some light on AI and problem gambling.
You sure did. Thanks, mate.
Thanks, bye.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode of the Gambling Files podcast, please share, tell your friends, follow us on Twitter, follow us on LinkedIn. You'll find us on the Gambling Files podcast on LinkedIn and on Twitter. We're something else. And come back next week for another great episode, hopefully.